Okay. All right. Thank you very much for those kind comments and that wonderful introduction. And you're actually doing a great job of giving my talk, probably better than I could do. So anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Shirley and Pat and everyone else for making this possible and giving me a chance to kind of share some of the research that we've been doing, you know, in my group over the last year or so, just the last year, you know, since I arrived at Northwestern. And so I put together a set of slides that will kind of highlight some of the things that Joanne was talking about and get into some additional details on what we think is possible. You know, I'll try to do that fairly rapidly here, you know, within 35 minutes or so. I want to also thank Morty for his kind words and introductory remarks, although I don't know why everything has to be a competition with you, Morty. I mean, it's some kind of character flaw I think you have. So I'm going to do my best, but I told Morty, you had two guys. I only have one guy up here, right? So if I can do half as well as you, I think I'm doing fine. Had I known it was a competition, I'd brought a friend, you know, to help me out up here. But anyway, let me kind of step you through some of the things that we've been working on. My core expertise is in electronic material science. And so a lot of what I do is basic ivory tower, academic, you know, basic scientific research. And, you know, we do that, you know, with the best of them. But we're also interested in translation and development of technologies around new insights into electronic materials that, you know, could have an impact in medical science and rehabilitation science. And so we're very much attracted to this interface between engineering and science and medicine. And that's kind of what I'll talk to you about. I won't get into a lot of the underlying science, but talk to you about devices and technologies and things that we have, you know, under human subject studies at various levels here at the Ability Lab and elsewhere across the you know, medical complex here. So yeah, I've got to be careful. I have props, not quite as impressive as Joanne's props, but I brought toys. And so I'll pass those around, you know, as I go through, so you can just get a better sense of the technology. So what we've been interested in, I think over the last decade or so, is thinking about, you know, electronic materials from the standpoint of integration with the human body. And it's probably easiest to think about that opportunity in the context of the human brain, which is biology's most sophisticated form of electronics. And so if you want to understand how the brain works, or you want to develop fundamentally new therapies to treat brain disorders, it might make sense to think about, you know, how to leverage man's most sophisticated form of electronics, you know, the silicon integrated circuit that you have in your pocket and in your laptop computer, to be biocompatible, to reformulate this kind of technology, to adapt to the soft, complex contours and time dynamic shapes that you find ubiquitous in biological systems. So how could I create an integrated circuit that could laminate onto the contoured surface of the brain, drop down into the sulci, into the inner hemispheric fissure to map electrical activity and tease out, you know, the behavior of the brain by study of direct study of neural circuits and maybe even deliver therapies through electrical stimulation. That's kind of a vision that's been guiding our research. And if you could figure out how to do that, you know, from the standpoint of new materials and new device designs and manufacturing approaches, you wouldn't stop there. You would leverage that same kind of technology to achieve integration with other vital organs of the human body, such as the heart, which was an electromechanical system. And so you might want to wrap an electronic circuit around the outside surface of the heart, completely around that surface, to allow high-resolution spatiotemporal electrophysiological mapping of the intrinsic, you know, electrical activity associated with beating of the heart, so you might be able to pick up an arrhythmia at a very early stage, and then maybe deliver spatiotemporal patterns of electrical stimulation to eliminate that arrhythmia, allowing levels of complexity and control in pacemaking to go far beyond the kind of point contact catheters that are used today. And then, you know, the skin would be another organ of interest, maybe the largest organ of the human body. If you could figure out how to create an integrated circuit that you kind of melt seamlessly into the epidermis surface itself, you might be able to use the skin as a window for measuring underlying body processes as a way to determine physiological health status in a wearable fashion, but with clinical grade precision, data streams that physicians can actually interpret and act upon. And so that's kind of what I'm going to focus on. We've done a lot of work in all three of these organ systems, but this talk will really focus on the skin. But bear in mind, the same ideas that I'll talk to you about and the same kind of capabilities can be deployed on internal organs of the body as well. And so for skin integration, you might immediately think, well, this guy's just going to tell me about wearable technologies. And in some ways, what we're working on is wearable in that sense, but radically different from what's available commercially. And so if you look at the wearable space right now, it's exploding in growth, and there are hundreds of different variants of devices with all kinds of different functionality. But you shouldn't mistake that breadth for diversity in engineering design, because they all use the same design approach. It's a rigid, blocky piece of electronics, loosely coupled to the body with a strap in general. And so it's great if you want to make a qualitative measurement of activity level, you want to count steps. But if you want to measure ECG, for example, that's really outside of the scope of what this kind of platform is capable of doing, because it doesn't offer that intimate skin interface that's critically important for all kinds of clinical grade measurements that are currently done in a hospital or a laboratory setting. And so what we've sought to do is to develop foundational scientific ideas that allow you to move away from this physical format of electronics into electronic platforms that physically look like the skin in terms of their thickness, their weight, their elastic properties, and so on, to allow kind of an imperceptible integration with the surface of the skin that's conceptually similar to that of a kid's temporary tattoo. So it goes on the skin, perfectly intimate interface for this kind of precision measurement capability, but physically imperceptible once it's on the skin, because there's no mechanical or mass or thermal loading of the surface of the skin. So you put it on, you don't even know it's there, and you can leave it there over time. And I won't go into all the ideas in engineering and material science that have allowed this to happen, but it is possible today. And this is a picture of a device that we published back in 2011. This is really just a platform that shows that you can build a system that has all the key building blocks of more sophisticated electronic functionality in this kind of skin-like form. So there's an array of transistors as building blocks for integrated circuits. There's an array of different kinds of sensors, strain sensors, temperature sensors, motion sensors. There's an antenna for wireless communication and an inductive coil that allows you to wirelessly transfer power to these devices, so you eliminate the need for battery mode of operation. And I won't go through all the details, but not only can you build that kind of skin-like electronics, but you can map into that platform all kinds of sensor functionality, a lot of which quantitatively corresponds to clinical predicates. In some cases, these sensors offer new modes of operation that really aren't available, even in the most sophisticated hospital systems. And I'll step you through some of these, but I won't have time during this talk to do a deep dive into any but a very small subset. So you can do, for example, thermal characterization. You can determine with millikelvin precision the temperature of the skin. You can map that spatially and temporally. You can measure thermal transport, hydration. You've got electrical properties, so you do ECG, electrocardiograms, muscle activity, brain activity. You can measure hydration electrically as well. As I'll show you in a little bit, you can actually capture sweat. You can route that sweat around into microchannels and microreservoirs, and you can do quantitative analysis of biomarkers in sweat, again, as a way to determine characteristics of health and exercise physiology. You can measure strain and motion and modulus of the skin, pressure associated with pulsatile blood flow through near surface arteries. You can do optical characterization of the skin, so you can determine blood oximetry, for example. You can measure time variations in that blood oximetry, photoplethysmography. You can map veins. You can do mechanoacoustic sensing as well, heart sounds, sounds associated with vibratory motions of the throat during speech, as Joanne mentioned. I'll get into the details of that in a second. Just a whole range of different kinds of capabilities built up over the last decade of research. And one of the things that motivated a move from University of Illinois, where I spent 13 years, to Northwestern is to get these kind of capabilities intimately coupled into the medical community here, and the rehabilitation community in particular. And so I have had collaborations with Rick Lieber over the years, and seeing this new building come up was an important consideration as I began to think about where to relocate from University of Illinois. So this has been a fantastic interaction with the folks here, and I'll step you through a number of different things that we're doing with a focus on the Ability Lab, but this is kind of a subset of the broader activities we have at this medical engineering interface. Let me start with an example of the kind of value that this technology brings. brings to modern clinical medicine. This is a target area that we've had on our sights for about 5 years. This slide itself is about five years old, and it's in vital signs monitoring for neonatal intensive care unit monitoring of premature babies. And so, as many of you know, if you go into the NICU today, even at Lurie's here, a very sophisticated NICU facility, this is the kind of engineering solution that's used to monitor vital signs in these fragile babies, the premature babies, the health status is fragile. You need to do 24/7 vital signs. That's full vital signs monitoring continuously. And the way that it's done is with hardwired connections, tape-based interfaces between electrodes and sensors and the skin and external data acquisition electronics. And the disadvantages and the limitations of this kind of approach are pretty apparent, at an intuitive level. One is that the skin in these preemies is not even really like skin. It's almost like jello or gelatin. And so the idea of applying these kinds of adhesive tapes repetitively on and off as you have to clean the baby, you have to rewire it up, in many cases leads to lifetime scar. So obviously a problem. The other thing is that there's a weight and a bulk and a mechanical constraint associated with the wires, which frustrates natural motions of the babies because their muscles are not very well developed at this age of their lives. And then as we've gone through and consented parents, in the kinds of studies I'll show you in the next couple of slides, what we found is that the main value to the parents actually is if you can get rid of these wires and replace them with these kind of skin-like tattoo devices, it makes it much easier for mothers to interact with their children. And that mother-child skin-to-skin contact is known to be critically important to the healthy development of a child at this age of their lives. And currently, in order to hold the baby, you have to take all this stuff off. You hold the baby, you put it back in the isolate, you got to mount it back on again. And so it becomes a real constraint in that kind of interaction. And so, like I said, this is 5 years old, and so at the time, this is just Photoshop, but it sort of encapsulates a vision of what we had in mind back in those days, is to really get rid of all this kind of clunky hardware and replace it with these sort of skin-like tattoos to reproduce the kind of functionality that's happening now, but without any of those disadvantages. And so we were able to do all of that, actually, and we were able also to get IRB approval of these kinds of devices into the NICU at Lurie's. And so at this point, we're doing these kinds of measurements on real babies on a weekly basis, and I'll give you an idea of how these technologies work. Let me start with the device that's capturing ECG waveforms and surface temperature of the skin. It's a device that looks like this. It goes on the chest. It has that full kind of tattoo-like physical construction, battery-free, so we have an antenna here that harvests wirelessly transmitted power from an antenna that sits in the base of the isolette, deliver power to the electronics, and then it also captures wirelessly data streams continuously coming back out of the device. And it captures, like I said, surface temperature of the skin and also electrocardiograms at full quantitative level. So if you put this on the chest, this is the kind of data that you can collect purely wirelessly, and this is the kind of data you collect with a standard, clunky, wired-based interface. And we get very good quantitative agreement between these two data streams. And from those kinds of traces, you can determine key insights into cardiovascular health, obviously, but you can also determine heart rate variability, and respiration rate. So it gets you a lot of the vital signs, not all of them, but this is one patch on the chest. It has the ability to do this kind of thing. The other thing that you can do is because you can wirelessly transmit enough power to run not only the operational amplifiers and the radios needed for that chest-mounted device, but you can also operate LEDs. And so you can operate, in particular, red and IR LEDs and a photodetector, and by measuring the backscattered light associated with operation of those LEDs, you can determine blood oxygenation, and you can measure the time dependence of the blood oxygenation associated with pulsatile blood flow through near surface arteries. So you can capture, you can do photoplethysmography as well. And with one device like the one I described previously on the chest, a device like that on the foot, you can reconstitute full vital signs from these kinds of device platforms. This is a picture of the first baby that we're able to test these technologies. You can see the isolate here. The mattress obviously is there. The transmission and receive antenna is in the base of that mattress, delivering power up to this device on the chest and one on the foot, and capturing data streams coming back off of those devices at the same time. And so this was a long slog for us. If you think about it, it's a decade worth of material science research sort of culminating at this level. So it was a very satisfying slide, one of my favorite slides, in fact, because of that. This is an outcome of a long period of work in the group. But this is also sort of interesting because this is also an outcome of group activity. Actually, a postdoc got married to a graduate student, and they had that baby. So it makes it extra special. For that reason. So we work with Amy Poller, who's head of dermatology here, because the skin interface is so important. But we also work with Debbie Weissmeyer and Aaron Hamvas, who are in neonatology, to give you a sense of it. So we're in the NICU, we're also in the PICU, and so we do term babies as well, as a way to get rid of the wired hardware in that context. And as you go through this, you develop sort of insights and your validation of some of the engineering goals that we've had since the very beginning. And so typically we like to measure with our wireless devices at the same time we're measuring with clinical gold standards. So we can do quantitative comparison of the fidelity of the data streams. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. As you can see, this guy really does not like wires, it turns out. And so we're trying to get this lead. That one was fine. It was very difficult to get him to allow us to keep this lead on this arm. And so after about 15 minutes of struggling with this baby, we decided to just give up. And throughout that struggle, he never seemed to realize he had anything on his chest. And so that was the kind of the whole point of the engineering. And so I actually have one of these devices. This is not as nice as the demo that Joanne had. This is not a live baby, obviously. But just to give you a sense of the size and the scale and the way the devices interact with the babies, this is an example. And there are actually devices on the wrist of that baby, and I'll come back to what those devices are all about in two slides. So the point is to take the engineering all the way to the system level, from the base material science discovery to devices, systems, and even software interfaces. Ultimately, we want to get things in a hospital. You can't just drop off a device. You have to have a graphical user interface so the attending nurses can actually make measurements when you're not around. So we spend a lot of time on that. Our expertise is not in software, but we do a decent job of that. So you can see ECG here. This is SCG, so we're measuring heart sounds. That goes beyond, in fact, what's done even with wired-based systems at Lurie's today. This is the red channel of that optical measurement technique I mentioned to you before. This is the IR channel, so you get blood oxygenation and PPG waveforms in that way. So we've done about 40 babies. It took us about 9 months just to get IRB approval, but we're approved. We're in there almost every week, consenting parents and then doing experiments on babies. The youngest babies that we've looked at are 26-week delivery babies. This is actually one of a pair of twins. So very, very tiny, very, very fragile babies. And I think it really makes good use of the underlying technology. And so that is very much ongoing. The other thing that we're doing in this space is a very recent effort. Shirley reached out just a month and a half ago, I think. We had a meeting here at Ability Lab, and she identified this problem in quantifying asynchronous sort of random movements that can sometimes signal at a very early stage of life cerebral palsy, and so cerebral palsy, and so the question is, how do you identify that kind of asynchronous motion early enough to make an intervention that's meaningful? And the way that it's done today is by video analysis. And so you take a video image, and then you do signal processing and image processing on those videos. But it's very difficult because the motions are highly complex. And deploying that kind of approach in the home or at a large scale in a clinical environment doesn't look like it's a very feasible approach. And so Shirley came to us with her colleagues at Pathways and also folks at Easter Seals and asked whether it's possible to take some of the devices we're already using in the NICU and adapt them and modify them to address this particular measurement challenge. And so that was great problem statement for us because we already have a lot of capabilities in this space. And within a month and a half, we have working devices now. But let me give you a sense of what kind of condition we're trying to capture. So these are just videos that you can download from the web. And so this is sort of normal motion characteristics of a baby, and this is one that is likely to have CP. So this is the kind of asynchronous motion that we're attempting to capture, and you can see this in real babies in these images. So what you would ideally like to do is get some kind of full body kinematic measurement and then couple that with data analytics and algorithms to determine whether this kind of asynchronous motion is occurring or not, because detecting it very early, as Shirley has highlighted, becomes critically important. important in implementing care that can address this condition. So these are the devices that we've built, and so the baby that's maybe circulating around the room has devices of this type on each of the two wrists. And it's a soft, flexible, silicone encapsulated set of electronics that allow us to do muscle electrical measurements here, EMG, accelerometry at the wrist and the back of the hand. So you can measure motions like this with this customized type of device. And so here's one of these devices, operating, give you a sense of how it actually works. So again, this is the baby doll that's being passed around, and you sort of wiggle this around, and you can capture the motion characteristics in that way. And so I have a couple of additional devices I'll pass around just to give you a sense of the mechanics and the nature of the physical construction of these systems and their compatibility with the soft skin of babies at this particular age. So those are some things that we're doing in babies, premature babies, and babies who are at risk for CP. We're also launching efforts in measuring perinatal health and the health of expecting mothers, funded by the Gates Foundation. So you can do fetal ECG, fetal health monitoring, at the same time you're doing monitoring of the health of the mother. And this really exploits the fact that these devices each are operating wirelessly in a multimodal fashion, but you can mount them anywhere on the body, and you can operate them at the same time with good time synchrony. And so you can get a full body picture of health status with deployment of devices, in this way. And we have a large human subject study that will start in January. And so those particular devices are measuring ECG, so electrocardiograms, also measuring heart sounds, as I mentioned before. So this is seismocardiograms, photoplethysmography, as I mentioned previously. And from the time delay from the ECG signal and the arrival of pulsatile flows of blood in the periphery, you can actually capture a pulse arrival time metric that through a calibration allows you to continuously monitor systolic blood pressure. And so we have a cuffless way to do beat-to-beat blood pressure monitoring as well by using multiple devices of this type mounted on the body. And then simultaneously you get full three-axis axis accelerometry and EMG signals as well, depending on where the device is mounted across the body. So we are deploying these devices across the medical school, the medical complex here. We have probably 8 to 10 different human subject studies ongoing. I mentioned a couple of them. I'll highlight some additional ones that are in process. So we have these devices approved for use in the operating room with Michelle Cleo and Matt Potts in neurological surgery. So these are actually being used to monitor peripheral nerve activity in the context of interventional procedures on the spine. So a surgical safety-based tool that replaces wired hardware that's used today. We're funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation, Joanne mentioned this, for measuring body kinematics in Parkinson's patients. And so again, full body measurements to capture early signs of tremors to determine whether a patient is on their meds or off their meds from this kind of kinetic signature of tremors. Here at the Ability Lab, we have ongoing studies in stroke rehabilitation, so we're doing full body kinematics and also EMG measurements. And working with data experts here at the Ability Lab, we can take that data and determine the onset of spasticity, all in a purely automated way, not requiring an attending a clinician. And then, as I mentioned before, we're monitoring expecting mothers, their health, and the health of the unborn fetus in that case. Here are some images of patients that are wearing our devices and suffer from Parkinson's. So this is an example of kinematics associated with a patient who is on their medications, and there's a characteristic signature associated with their motion. Here's the same patient off their medications. And so it's not a dramatic difference, and so you really need high-precision sensors, multi-body positions, and you can see sort of a hitch and a step right there, and you can capture that and analyze that in a purely engineering fashion. Here's one of the patients that we're working with who has suffered a stroke and is undergoing rehabilitation from that condition. And so again, multiple devices mounted at different strategic locations on the body. Again, here we're measuring motion and EMG activity to determine onset of spasticity in motion. Shirley also mentioned this, but just to give you a sense of the degree to which these devices are customizable, we developed in response to an inbound request from Leora Cherney here at the Ability Lab, a device that would mount on the throat and measure mechanoacoustic signatures of speech in a way that would be important in monitoring speech patterns in patients who suffer from aphasia. But doing it in a way that's not just based on a microphone where you have complicating factors associated with ambient noise, but actually measuring physical vibration in the throat, in which case ambient noise issues go away. So I'll pass around one of these devices, some of the other devices that we're using for Parkinson's patients as well, just to give you a sense of the mechanics. Feel free to take them out and sort of play around with them. This is a device that kind of goes on the throat. There's another one. This is what it looks like. So we've deployed these devices on multiple patients. And the point here is to show that the signatures of speech associated with this patient are completely unaffected by voices in this group. So the ambient noise issue goes away, and you can capture directly the vibratory signatures associated with speech of the subject who's wearing the device. And so this has been a great collaboration. We're looking to expand the deployment of these devices and use them, you know, outside of the context of the Ability Lab at home. Some other things that we're pursuing involve control interfaces. So if you think about prosthetics and prosthetic control, the ability to pick up electrical signatures of muscle motions at the end of a residual limb, and then using those signals to control a prosthetic turns out to be an important and interesting deployment of these kinds of skin-like devices as well, because the thin skin-like nature is critically important to have an irritation-free interface between the residual limb and the prosthetic. Another example of what we're doing. We can also measure temperature and pressure at interface between the residual limb and the prosthetic to determine the fit and the quality of that interface. And this is a movie of a particular amputee that we've deployed our devices on. So our devices are living at the interface between the residual limb and this outer prosthetic socket, and we're continuously streaming wireless data around precision temperature and pressure measurements to determine the onset of irritation or problems at that skin device interface. So these are some of the things that we're doing in clinical medicine. The other thing that's happened since the move to Chicago, sort of out in the middle of nowhere in Urbana, it turns out, is we're getting a lot of inbound interest from professional sports organizations, and we've decided to engage with some subset of those inbound inquiries, because it's an interesting and demanding use case of the devices, because the extreme levels of motion and acceleration really sort of test the limits of the measurement capability. It also provides a great test case to determine sort of ultimate patient compliance around the device, because in this case, this is a minor league pitcher with the Cubs organization, and he's looking to get into the major leagues. He will not wear anything on his wrist because it might adversely affect his performance. He will not wear any kind of strap around his chest, but he didn't have any problem wearing our devices. And so we were able to use these devices on this starting pitcher in real games situations. And so that was an interesting, you know, test case around the notion of engineering soft devices to minimize, you know, perception and irritation at the skin interface. So here's an example of a clip from the fourth inning during which this pitcher is delivering pitches. Baseball is a little boring in my opinion. Got to speed it up a little bit. So we accelerated the video a little bit here. But this is multimodal measurement on the chest and the leg. What you're seeing is the chest acceleration profiles down here, and these are snapshots of the ECG traces that we're collecting at the same time. So you see very sharp peaks here, so we can get heart rate to very high precision, clinical grade precision, in an actual game situation. And we can also characterize the pitching mechanics from the kind of accelerometry signatures that we get. So you can see these bipolar signatures that corresponds to delivery of a pitch. These monopolar signatures correspond to when he dips down to grab a rosin bag. So you see a pitch there, and then he'll dip down, and you can see he grabs a rosin bag. So the Cubs are interested in really simple things like pitch count. Okay, we can do that. But we think we can determine sort of reproducibility and pitch mechanics as well. Sort of towards the middle of this fourth inning, he got into trouble, pitched here, and the batter got a hit, and all this apparent noise is actually characteristic of the pitcher needing to cover the bases as the ball is in play. But you can do analytics on this kind of data, and you see sort of interesting things. So we talked to our cardiologist colleagues here at Feinberg and showed them this data, and the immediate response was that this guy is undergoing tachycardia. He can't possibly survive this kind of thing for long, because his heart rate is 180. While he's in the game. And so this is an elite professional athlete whose resting heart rate is about 50 to 55 beats per minute, but it's 180, and we have very high precision, very high confidence on that number when he's in the game. When he comes out of the game onto the bench, the heart rate drops to about 110. So dramatic swings when he's in the game and out of the game, and sort of an asymmetry in terms of how that heart rate changes. So as he comes out of the game onto the bench, there's sort of a gradual decrease in heart rate. When he goes back into the game, boom, it's almost straight back up to 180 immediately. And so it's an indication that I think a lot of this very high heart rate behavior is associated with mental stress as much as it is with physical exertion and stress. So you see it's very high heart rate up into the middle of the fourth inning, and then as I mentioned, he started getting, batter started getting hits in this latter part of that fourth inning. You can see a lot of heart rate variability there. Maybe associated with additional mental stress, but also probably associated with the fact that he's running around trying to cover the bases. So anyway, this has turned out to be interesting. The students are very excited and enthusiastic about it. So these are this is the range of engagements that we have right now. The Lakers, just because it's the Lakers, that's cool. I grew up with Magic Johnson, so that seemed like a good one. And then the Falcons reached out around January. They went silent for a while. I think the Super Bowl was a little traumatic for the Falcons, but we re-engaged with them. The Bears, and then we also have engagements with Northwestern Athletics, swim team in particular. We're looking to expand that out into football and basketball. We're meeting with Jeff Majanes actually just this afternoon. So those are some of the things that we can do. Let me kind of shift gears, and then I'll sort of wrap up. So what I've described to you are sensors that operate sort of in a biophysical realm. And you can determine a lot. There's a lot of important information you can glean from those kind of physics-based measurements. But ultimately, the body is a biochemical system. And if you want to get deeper insights into health status, you need to analyze biochemical species, the concentrations of various important biomarkers. And so you need access to biofluids. And in fact, you need microfluidic handling capability to sample those fluids and do analysis on them in a controlled engineering fashion. So the question became, can you add to these electronic platforms microfluidic sorts of capabilities? And it turns out that you can, and it turns out that's not too hard. There are advanced materials that we've developed for this purpose, so you can develop super thin microfluidic platforms that have this kind of skin-like mechanics. And so the exploded view of one device, typical device, involves the microfluidic channels and adhesive interface to the underlying skin, thereby opening up certain regions of the skin such that the eccrine sweat glands can actively pump sweat into this microfluidic system. And then we have colorimetric chemical reagents that respond to concentrations of particular biomarkers through a color change. And so just by visualizing this device, you can get a very clear picture on your sweat chemistry, the sweat loss, the total sweat rate, as well. And so this is what one of these devices looks like. This is actually the very first paper we published as, you know, a Northwestern group. So this is kind of a milestone in some sense. This particular device has 5 inlet channels, exposed regions of the skin where sweat can flow up into the device. The central inlet channel connects to this serpentine structure here, and it's filled with a color-responsive material that changes from purple to red when in contact with water. And so you just eyeball this thing and determine the extent of filling of that serpentine channel. And from that, you can determine how much sweat loss has occurred from that local region of the skin. And it turns out you can calibrate that to total sweat body loss. So you can just look at this device and determine how much sweat you've lost at any given time. So you can determine instantaneous sweat rate, total sweat loss. The other 4 inlets connect to a separate collection of 4 distinct reservoirs, each one of which has a colorimetric chemical agent that responds through a color change to a concentration in a particular analyte that we're interested in. Lactate, for example, around muscle fatigue. Chloride of interest in determining total electrolyte loss. Glucose, for obvious reasons, and pH also is a good indicator of overall hydration status. So a very simple multifunctional platform that allows you to do multimodal analysis of sweat. And the key thing here, again, as with the electronics, is this soft skin-like construction, not simply due to the irritation-free interface with the skin, but in this case, the ability to maintain a watertight seal with the skin. So by having these things very thin and very soft, the interface stresses that develop as a result of natural deformations of the skin are minimized. And so you can maintain this very strong, watertight seal. And so this is an example, one of these devices on the arm. After sweating a little bit, you can see the extent of filling of that serpentine channel in these 4 wells there can be analyzed in terms of their color change to determine the concentration of those biomarkers that I mentioned to you before. So I have one of these devices here. And so we put a little bit of effort into sort of the aesthetics here, because we figure, you know, if things are going on somebody's skin, they need to have function, but they need to be visually appealing as well if you want to get broad adoption. So this was kind of our best effort at, you know, an artistic sort of design in the overall device. And the editors at the journal where we publish this, Science Translational Medicine, probably the most competitive journal for devices and technologies of this type, liked it as well. And so they chose it for a feature on the cover of the journal. This is November issue last year. But what was really cool is it turned out that the curators of the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, in New York, decided it was art. I was shocked, you know. I couldn't believe it. This is art, evidently. So that's cool, you know. And so they called up and said, we'd like to feature this device in MoMA. And I said, fantastic, let's do it. Yeah, so this opened just here end of September. So if you're in New York City, you can go and check it out. We have a very nice video to accompany the devices. There's an array of different device designs down here. And you can see my name, like I'm a real artist, got my name, American, born 1967. It's like, that's really cool, you know. So we knew we were pretty good at science and engineering. We never realized we had any artistic sense whatsoever, but that was sort of fun. The other thing that's happened is we were contacted by the National Kidney Foundation, and of course hydration is very important to kidney health, as well as creatinine concentration in sweat. And so we developed a specialized platform that would address those important issues in kidney health. And the National Kidney Foundation actually contracted with this guy, Tommy Helm, that guy right there, evidently like a celebrity tattoo artist. So they also felt like it's got to look cool if, you know, people are going to wear it. And so this is Tommy's art here. So it's HYK, heart your kidney, and there's a heart. And then we have a color analysis well that determines creatinine, and the color changes from transparent to red, depending on the concentration of creatinine, to sort of synergize with the heart there. And there's a channel that runs around here that determines total sweat loss. And so we've done these kinds of devices with professional sports teams as well, not just the Cubs, but a number of others. I'll show you some devices here in a second that we shipped to the Lakers, about 100 of them. They did their training camp a few weeks ago, so we shipped them out for that purpose. But this is another good test case. Can these devices operate robustly in this very demanding environment? And this is P.J. Higgins is actually an outfielder. He also plays catcher. This is in the majors, actually. He got called up as a minor league player, but he played against the Padres and the A's with our devices mounted up in the small of his back. So we had to convince P.J. a little bit, you know, kind of, you know, argue, you know, the value of this, and he finally agreed to do it. But what was interesting is just by coincidence, we finally got P.J. to agree to do it. First time up, hit a home run. And so at that point, everybody wanted a sweat patch. So that was kind of cool. So I'll pass around a few boxes of these sweat patches, different designs and different configurations for different applications. Just give you a sense. Feel free to take them out and sort of play around with them if you're interested. The other thing that happened is we were contacted by Shannon Harmon in pathology at Lurie's, and evidently, I didn't know this, but determining chloride concentration in sweat is a diagnostic technique that's used to determine whether a child has cystic fibrosis or not. And the way that that's done currently is basically with a hockey puck that you strap very tightly to the skin, and you use this to capture sweat, and then you do off-board lab-based analysis of the chloride concentration. The problem is you have about 25% failure rate. And it's painful for the kids. And so she called up and said, hey, could you use our device, your devices for this kind of application? We said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, that seems like a great, you know, opportunity. And so we've gone down that path. Here's the first baby that we did this with. I'm not sure he's fully convinced of this technology, actually. A little funny looking face there. But anyway, so far, at least the tests we've done, we've had no failures. It's just a soft, you know, laminated, you know, contact. There's really no pain involved, and there's no possibility for lateral leakage. So with that, let me just conclude with one final example of things that we're doing with the Ability Lab, this time in the context of this sweat monitoring patch. Again, inbound interest from folks here at the lab asking, you know, whether you know, we could think about adapting our technology for, you know, applications of need here. And that's very exciting for us. So we were contacted in the context of stroke rehabilitation. There's a lot of exercise involved. in that type of process and sort of tracking hydration levels, sweat loss, electrolyte loss is important, I am told, in that context. And we think we have a very unique, very powerful platform for that kind of thing. So here you go, Shirley. This is a custom sweat patch device for Ability Lab use. We have the graphics here. So it's Zoom chloride, and again, total sweat loss and instantaneous sweat rate as well. And we'll start that here in November. We have 50 subjects lined up, working closely with Arun and Rick and the rest of the team here. So anyway, that's all I had to say. I'll just conclude by highlighting again, you know, we think we have two very unique device platforms emerging from fundamental sort of academic research on new electronic materials, one that offers electronic sensing functionality and interface to the skin, and one that provides microfluidic capture and analysis capabilities. And these two things can very easily be brought together as well to make multimodal type of devices. So everything that we do is very highly collaborative. We are not experts in rehabilitation science or medical science, but it's great because we have the experts here, and we work very closely with them. This is a list of the folks that have contributed to the work that I just described to you on the medical side and the engineering side as well, very, very collaborative and interdisciplinary in that sense. I will conclude by just highlighting the fact that a lot of this research is being directly enabled by this new center that we have at Northwestern, the Center for Biointegrated Electronics. And Rick Lieber is one of the sort of inaugural members of the center faculty PIs. The center, we have engineering science and medical science well represented there. This is just the end of our very first year, but we're looking to sort of build this up. And here are pictures of the first four members, myself, longtime collaborator in mechanical engineering, Amy Pollard, longtime collaborator again in dermatology, and we've known Rick and worked closely with Rick for a number of years. But it's really possible due to the engagement and philanthropy of Kimberly Query and Lou Simpson, and they were absolutely critical in making this kind of thing happen. Turns out the government agencies fund the fundamental science pretty well, but the translational engineering that's needed to take things out of an academic lab and put them in a place like Ability Lab, that's much tougher. There are very few sources of funding you can go to at the federal level to enable that, and that's super important to us. And it's really being made possible by the engagement that we've had from Kimberly and Lou. So very, very, very important there. But at the end of the day, the most important people are the students and the postdocs and the undergrads. We have lots of undergrads involved in this kind of work who actually do the research. I just get to talk about it. And so I've been very blessed to work with extremely talented people over the years. This is a picture of the group back in Urbana just before sort of making the transition to Evanston here. And it's a big group. It looks a little bit bigger than it really is because it's a family event. That's not a postdoc, and that's not a graduate student, but just give you a sense of this. And they're very dedicated. And so I'm going to leave you with an image that you can take home with you, the next slide, because they're really willing to do almost anything to further the research. And so these devices, I showed you mounted on the chest and the arms and so on. Turns out you can also mount them on the head to determine brain activity, brain waves, essentially. And that works well on babies, not a lot of hair. But we need to do some initial testing in our group to sort of refine the technology before taking it into the clinic and into babies. And so we have students who are willing to dispense with the hair to allow us to test the devices. So this is a grad student who shaved his head, and you can see our electronics mapped all around the surface of the skull so we can monitor underlying brain activity in this way. So that's all I had. I thank you again for your attention. So you can read some of these devices on the phone. That's one possible interface. We also have special sort of wireless electronics that we use for the NICU devices. And so a lot of the IRB approval focused on the RF operation of that electronics to make sure it wasn't going to interfere with anything else going on. But we have different kinds of device platforms, different modes of wireless communication. Some of them work directly with the phone. Other ones require more specialized interface. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you see a future where we actually have the neural circuitry integrated with electronic circuitry in the brain? A chip that can really complement our, you know, our brain and give us some superpowers. Is that
yeah? So
how
soon
is that going to happen?
I guess, yeah. That kind of thing may be, you know, out into the future ways, because I think there isn't a great fundamental understanding of how the brain operates. And so thinking about how to engineer interfaces with the brain without that level of understanding kind of limits what you can do. But there are, as you probably know, electronic devices that are used to treat important disorders of the brain. Deep brain stimulators turn out to be very effective in the context of Parkinson's. And so that's pure empiricism based on just very simple electrode interfaces. And so I think it's pretty natural to think that if you had a much more scalable and much more programmable electronic interface, even if you don't know how the brain is working, maybe you could empirically use deep learning techniques, artificial intelligence, to look at the response of the patient and dial in an appropriate spatiotemporal type of stimulation to do something more sophisticated. So I think that's probably how it's going to progress, maybe in parallel with basic research in on the neuroscience of how the brain is working. But absent that understanding, it's hard to, in a deterministic, predefined way, understand how to do that interface. But I think there's plenty of low-hanging fruit that just rely on kind of an empirical understanding. Yeah. Okay.